All right, hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Am I Remembering This Correctly? This is the show where we take a look at some of history's most intriguing people and events. I'm your host, Caleb Giles, and on today's episode, we'll be taking a look at one of the most peculiar Olympic events that ever took place at the 1904 Olympics in St. Louis. I thought this episode would be a great segue into the 2020 Tokyo Olympics that are happening next week. So yeah. The 1904 was the first Olympics that the United States ever hosted, and it may have been its worst, or at least the most bizarre out of all of them. The games were tied to that year's corresponding World's Fair, which celebrated the centennial anniversary of the Louisiana Purchase, while advancing, as did all such turn-of-the-century expositions, the notion of American imperialism. Although there were moments of surprising and genuine triumph, such as gymnast George Iser earning 6 medals, which included three gold ones, despite his wooden leg, the Olympic Games were largely overshadowed by the World's Fair, which offered its own roster of sporting events, including the controversial Anthropology Days, in which a group of savages, quote-unquote, recruited from the fair's international village, competed in a variety of athletic feats, among them a greased pole climb, ethnic dancing, and mudslinging, all for the amusement of Caucasian spectators. Pierre de Coubertin, a French historian and founder of the International Olympic Committee, took disapproving note of the spectacle and made a prescient observation. And he quotes, "As for that outrageous charade, it will of course lose its appeal when black men, red men, and yellow men learn to jump and throw and leave the white men behind them." Of the runners who stood on the marathon starting line, a handful had run previously in the Boston Marathon, but mainly the field was comprised of a hodgepodge collection of middle distance specialists or distance running novices who had never attempted anything like a marathon in their lives before. And a marathon, that's a pretty big step from just going walking around your neighborhood, maybe doing a 5K to a marathon. So I guess that shows you that event was already off to a great start. The Olympics signal event, the marathon, was conceived to honor the classical heritage of Greece and underscore the connection between the ancient and modern Olympics. Because, the whole Greek battle at Thermopylae, messenger ran back down the path. It was 26 miles. You got the whole marathon distance. Yeah, you know the spiel. It wasn't very honorable, because from the start of the 1904 marathon, it was less showstopper and more than a freakish sideshow spectacle, and it seemed more in keeping with the carnival atmosphere of the World's Fair than the reverential mood of the actual Olympic Games. The outcome, in fact, was so scandalous that it almost led to the marathon being abolished from the Olympic Games for good. The organizers of this year's Tokyo Olympics in 2020, fun fact, have moved the marathon to the northern city of Sapporo to avoid the blistering heat and humidity of the summer in the capital. In August 1904, however, marathon runners had no choice but to compete in the sweltering heat of the Midwest summer. Temperatures that day soared above 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and the humidity rate was more than 90%. A few of the runners were recognized marathoners who had either won or placed in the Boston Marathon before, or they had placed in previous Olympic marathons, but the majority was composed of assorted oddities and casual runners. Americans Sam Miller, A.L. Newton, John Lorden, Michael Spring, and Thomas Hicks, all experienced marathoners, were among the favorites. Another American, Fred Lors, did all his training at night because he had a day job as a bricklayer and earned his spot in the Olympics by placing in a special 5-mile race sponsored by the Amateur Athletic Union, or AAU for short. Among the leading oddities who had never run before were 10 Greeks who had never run a marathon or distance longer than 10 miles. Two men of the Tswana tribe of South Africa were also present, and they were in St. Louis as part of the South African World's Fair exhibit, and they arrived at the starting line barefoot. There was also a Cuban national and former mailman named Felix Cabarro, who raised money to come to the States by demonstrating his running prowess throughout Cuba, once trekking the length of the island. Upon his arrival in the United States in New Orleans, he lost all his money gambling on a dice game, and he had to walk and hitchhike to St. Louis. At 5 feet tall, he presented a slight but striking figure at the starting line. He arrived dressed in a white long-sleeve shirt, long dark pants, and a beret, and a pair of street shoes. Very different attire than what the Americans are wearing. One fellow Olympian took pity on him. He found a pair of scissors and actually cut Carabao's trousers at the knee so he would have, you know, a better time running, more range of motion, all that jazz. And the story actually goes that in this marathon, Cabarro would have won if he had not eaten an unripe apple in an orchard right before taking a nap to sleep off the resulting tummy ache in the middle of the marathon. Cabarro did eventually cross the starting line, and he crossed it in fourth place. And he even wasn't the person who had it worse in this marathon, and I guess that's another thing that shows you how crazy this marathon was, is that this person fell asleep during the marathon and finished in fourth place. On August 30th, at precisely 3:03 p.m., David R. Francis, the president of the Louisiana Purchase Expedition Company, fired the starting pistol and the men were off. He and humidity soared into the 90s, and the 24.85-mile course, which one fair official called the most difficult a human being has ever been asked to run over, wound across roads inches deep in dust. The start included 5 laps around the stadium track. The rest, of course, was on dusty country roads with race officials riding vehicles ahead and behind of the runners, creating dust clouds that acerbated to the severely hot and humid conditions. There were 7 hills varying from 100 to 300 feet high, some with brutally long ascents. In many places, cracked stone was strewn across the roadway, creating perilous footing, and the men had to constantly dodge cross-town traffic, delivery wagons, railroad trains, trolley cars, and people walking their dogs. So, you know, they didn't close off the track or anything. They went through the middle of the city, and people are driving, trying to get to work, walking their dog. Imagine clocking in 10 minutes late and your boss is all on you about how you're late, and you have to explain to them that you got caught behind the Olympic runners. That's probably worse than your dog eating your homework. Along the course, there were only 2 places where athletes could secure fresh water. One was from a water tower at the 6-mile mark, and the other was at a roadside well at the 12-mile mark. James Sullivan, the chief organizer of the games, wanted to minimize fluid intake to test the limits and effects of purposeful dehydration, a common area of research at the time. There were cars carrying coaches and physicians that motored alongside the runners that kicked up dust and launched coughing spells in many of the runners. Fred Lors led the 32 starters from the gun, but by the 1st mile, Thomas Hicks had edged ahead of him. William Garcia of California nearly became the first fatality of an Olympic marathon when he collapsed on the side of the road and was hospitalized with hemorrhaging because the dust had coated his esophagus and ripped his stomach lining. Had he gone unaided for an hour longer, historians and doctors say, he might have bled to death. John Lorden, on the other hand, suffered a bout of vomiting and gave up. Len Tao, one of the South One of the South African participants was chased a mile off course by wild dogs. Felix Carvalho trotted along in his cumbersome shoes and billowing shirt, making good time even though he paused to chat with spectators in broken English. On one occasion, he stopped at a car and saw its occupants were eating peaches and asked for one. Being refused, he playfully snatched two of them and ate them as he ran. Suffering from foot cramps, he later lay down to take a nap. The other competitor, Sam Miller, now in the lead, also experienced severe cramping. He slowed to a walk and eventually stopped. At the 9-mile mark, cramps also plagued Lors, who decided to hitch a ride in one of the accompanying automobiles, waving at spectators and fellow runners as he passed. So this man's running a marathon, and at the nine mile meter, he gets in one of the judges' cars and has them drive him past all the other racers, and he's waving at all the spectators, and they're all cheering at him, even though he's bluntly cheating. Back to another competitor, Hicks. He was one of the early American favorites, and he came under the care of a 2-man support crew at the 10-mile mark. He begged them for a drink of water, but instead the doctors refused, and they focused on sponging out his mouth with warm and distilled water. At 7 miles from the finish, his handlers fed him a concoction of strychnine and egg whites, the first recorded instance of a drug use in the modern Olympics. Strychnine, commonly used in rat poison, in small doses, was commonly used as a stimulant at the time, and there were no rules about performance-enhancing drugs. Hicks' team also carried a flask of French brandy, but decided to withhold it until they could gauge the runner's condition. Meanwhile, Lors, recovered from his cramps, emerged from his 11-mile ride in the automobile. One of Hicks' handlers saw him and ordered him off the course, but Lors kept running and finished with a time of just under 3 hours. The crowd roared and began chanting, "An American won!" Alice Roosevelt, the 20-year-old daughter of President Roosevelt, placed a wreath upon Lors' head and took a picture with him. And just as she was about to lower the gold medal around his neck, a witness from the crowd ran out and said someone called an indignant halt to the proceedings with charge that Lors was an imposter. The cheers turned to boos, and Lors smiled and claimed that he never intended to accept the honor. He only finished for the sake of a joke. So this man's about to get his gold medal, and someone from the crowd stands up and says, "This man over here witnessed it and told me to say it. So he told me to tell you to tell him that he cheated." And that's all it took for the crowd to turn against him. And even though he did cheat, it was just, hey, he told me he cheated. I didn't actually see it. And, well, I mean, they believed him. So whatever, he got caught. That proves that cheaters never win. After that, Lors was banned from competing for life. And, of course, the punishment was not stuck to. His sanction was actually lifted after a heartfelt apology. And Lors won the Boston Marathon the following year. So cheaters never win. But also, if you're nice and you rely on the kindness of strangers, I guess you can do big things. Lors actually wasn't the last imposter or person to try and cheat through the Olympic marathon. During the 1972 games in Munich, student Norbert Sahau charged into the stadium dressed in full West German running gear. And he actually came in just in front of the actual leader. The crowd began cheering for one of their own, while the American Frank Shorter watched in confusion and panic as Sahau crossed the finish line first. The prankster kept on running and disappeared later down the tunnel from which he came. Shorter was later proclaimed the winner, but was cruelly denied his moment of glory and cheers. The South African entrants, Lin Tao and Jim Mashami, finished 9th and 12th respectively. This was seen as a disappointment, although many observers were sure that Lin Tao could have placed top three if he and his if he and his friend had not been chased off the course by feral dogs. And Lin Tao had a very big concern over rabies, and he has gone on record to say that not getting rabies was more important to him than the actual marathon and the glory he would have received. Another runner, arriving without correct documents, Albert Corey, was a French immigrant to the United States, and he is inconsistently listed as performing in a mixed team in the 4-mile race, with four undisputed Americans, and performing for the U.S. in the marathon. So there was a French man who even ran under the United States flag, and they didn't even know he wasn't American until after the marathon, and he placed like 15th. And you know, back down the road, Hicks is still going. Of course, the strychnine rat poison coursing through his blood. He had grown ashen and limp, and when he heard that Lors had been disqualified as a false finisher, he perked up and forced his legs into a trot. His trainers gave him another dose of strychnine. Ah, yes, more rat poison and eggs. And this time they gave him brandy to wash it down. Just a suggestion here, you probably shouldn't drink alcohol while you're running your marathon, but if any of you decide to go out and run a marathon, you do you. But I wouldn't suggest it. They fetched warm water and soaked his body and head. After the bathing, he appeared to revive and quickened his pace. Over the last 2 miles of the road, wrote race official Charles Lucas, Hicks was running mechanically, like a well-oiled piece of machinery. His eyes were dull, lustrous, and the ashen color of his face and skin had deepened. His arms appeared as weights and well tied down. He could scarcely lift his legs with his knees, and his knees were almost stiff. Hicks began hallucinating, believing that the finish line was still 20 miles away. In his last mile of the race, he begged for something to eat. Then he begged to lie down. He was given more brandy, but refused to drink tea. He swallowed two more egg whites, and he walked up the first of the last two hills, then jogged down the incline. Swinging into the stadium, he tried to run, but was reduced to a graceless shuffle. The trainers carried a drunken Hicks over the finish line, holding him aloft while his feet moved back and forth, and he was declared the winner. It took four doctors in 1 hour for Hicks to feel well enough just to leave the grounds in the stadium. He had lost nearly 8 pounds during the race and declared, "Never in my life have I run such a touch course. The terrific hills simply tear me into pieces." Hicks and Lors would meet again at the Boston Marathon the following year, which Lors won without the aid of anything but his legs. Only 14 of the 32 competitors crossed the finish line this year, and the victor's time, of course Hicks, was 3 hours, 28 minutes, and 45 seconds, and was the slowest of all Olympic runners since 1896 by almost 30 minutes, despite the course being nearly 2 miles shorter than today's distance. Mercifully, and thankfully, nobody died in the St. Louis Olympics. However, 8 years later, in Stockholm, the Olympic marathon claimed its first and only fatality when Portuguese runner Francisco Lazaro collapsed after 19 miles. He had covered his body in animal fat to prevent sunburn. Unable to sweat properly, he fell victim to overheating and severe electrolyte imbalance. His memorial service took place in the Olympic Stadium, and it attracted a crowd of 23,000 well-wishers, which is kind of a low number if you think about how many people are going to watch the Olympics every year, and one of the main racers die and only 23,000 people showed up. I guess everybody else was just taking their time in the Olympic Village. Anyways, I think that's a good enough place to end this in today's episode. And that just concludes our sprint through the story of the 1904 Olympic marathon and its absolute absurdity and the otherwise prestigious history of the Olympic Games. Please make sure to follow me on Instagram at AIRTC.podcast for updates and notifications whenever new episodes come out. And with that, I hope you all enjoyed this episode, and I hope everyone has an amazing day. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this is Caleb signing off.